This lecture is brought to you by the Orsemer Tape Library. The cassette library offers a wide range of lecturers and topics. For details, contact the Orsemer Tape Library branch nearest you.
To finish up, before we get into the actual topics, we're still talking about the structure of the Torah Shebal Peh, the oral law. And what we had done yesterday was to enumerate the separate components of the oral law based on, and the main source of this is the Rambam's introduction. As you know, as I mentioned yesterday, that was directed to the Mishnah. As you mentioned yesterday, for hundreds and hundreds of years, there was a prohibition in Halacha to write down the oral law. The oral law had to be remained, had to remain. Finally, however, around the time of the destruction, or actually somewhat after the destruction of the Second Temple, the first rudiments of the oral law were finally written down in what we know as the Mishnah. The Mishnah was authored by Rav Yehuda HaNasi, Rav Yehuda the Prince, who was the head of the Sanhedrin. But, of course, he did so with the authorization of the entire Sanhedrin. And why was the Torah Shebal Peh finally written down? So we have really two basic reasons which overlap. One is that it became like a snowball. It was getting larger and larger and larger all the time, and it was very difficult to commit the whole thing to memory. And that's why if Chas V'Shalom, there was some fear that the oral law would have been forgotten, so it had to be written down. And now you may wonder, how did it last for so long? Keep in mind that, you know, we're not used to memorizing things so much, but, you know, in the ancient world, you know, the Iliad and the Odyssey, Homer's epic poems, were transmitted orally for hundreds and hundreds of years until they were written down. Basically, you know, and they're very huge. Also, there are American Indian tribes which did not have a written language. And they would convey all sorts of stories and epics that would go on for thousands and thousands of pages, and they could do it orally. But eventually there was this fear that the Torah Shebal Peh would be forgotten. And also it was a time of persecutions, a time of Roman persecutions against Jews, so rabbis were being killed, etc. This was the famous story of the 10 martyrs. We read on Yom Kippur, Rabbi Akiva and all these other people were being killed. So the Chachamim looked at a verse in Tehillim, in Psalms, that says, Eis lasos l'Hashem. It is a time to stand up for the protection of God, Heferu Torasecha, when the Torah is at risk of being lost. Which means, in effect, what this was, this was a rabbinic dispensation to violate a halacha for a temporary duration in order to safeguard the long-term integrity of the oral law. It's a dangerous idea. You have to know when to say it, when not to say it. But essentially what they said was, we will violate halacha A in order to ensure that the rest of the Torah shall not be lost. And this is the interpretation, Heferu Torasecha, when it's a time to stand up for God, Heferu Torasecha, we can actually annul the Torah, provided we have a Sanhedrin that can give us this type of authorization. Now, the Mishnah, as you know, consists of six orders. Order number one is Zeraim, which deals with agriculture. And that's mainly laws pertaining to Israel. There are very few agricultural laws outside of the land of Israel. But in Israel, if you have a field, it's very complicated. In fact, people say, you know, is it easy to keep kosher in Israel? It's harder to keep kosher in Israel than it is in the United States. Because in the United States, wherever I am, I know I can buy an apple in a store and I can eat it. Although we have pesticides problems there, you have to be sure to wash your apple. In Israel, I got all these problems that you have to take off the tithes and the truth to give to the Kohen and the Meiser, the 10% that you give to a Levi and everything else. So in Eretz Israel, even vegetables have conscious problems. So that is the first order dealing with the Zeraim. Zeraim is also called the order of Emunah, the order of faith. Why is it called the order of faith? Because the farmer, more than most of us, realizes how totally dependent they are on Hashem. Because a farmer knows if it's not going to rain today, you know, the crop may die. And therefore the farmer naturally turns to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in a way that most of us don't. Now the truth is, even the lawyer and the doctor, their success depends totally on God. But a lawyer may tend to think that it's his skill that gets him through life. But the farmer knows that skill isn't enough. That the farmer knows that it depends totally on Hashem. And therefore it's called the order of Emunah. There is no Gemara, which is the explanation of the Mishnah, on the order of Zeraim, except for the first tractate, which is Brachos, dealing with blessings, because since the Gemara, at least the Babylonian Gemara, was written in Bavel, and in Bavel was not Eretz Yisrael, so there is no Gemara on that. All there is Mishnah. We then have the second order, which is Moed, dealing with holidays, And there, of course, you have Shabbos, Pesach, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, all the different holidays. Then we have Nashim, dealing with family law, that's marriage and divorce, etc. Then we have Nezikin, which is civil law, contracts, partnerships, torts, that's Bava Metzia, Bava Kama, etc. Then we have Kadshim, dealing with sacrifices. And then we have Taharos, dealing with the laws of purity and impurity. Yeah?
Was there a Gemara on Kadshim?
Yes, an interesting question. There is no Gemara on Zerayim, as I mentioned, because it was a product of Babylon. And yet, there is a Gemara on Kadshim, dealing with the laws of sacrifices, although sacrifices, too, are only limited to when there's a Beis HaMikdash. If anything, Zerayim is even more applicable than Kadshim, because Zerayim applies in Israel even when there's no temple. Kadshim doesn't even apply in Israel. And yet, they did write a Gemara on Kadshim. It's a very intriguing observation. We don't know exactly why. Presumably, the notion was that because there was such a strong belief in the coming of Mashiach and the eventual restoration of the Beis HaMikdash, the way they affirmed their belief in the imminent coming of Mashiach was to get involved in the details of the temple service.
Okay, what was Nashim and
Nezikin? Okay, Nashim is family law. Literally, Nashim means women. So it has marriage, divorce, etc. Nezikin literally means damages, but that deals with civil law. So, for example, the Jewish law of contracts and torts and inheritance rights and the court system and punishments, criminal law, would all be in Nezikin. In most of the yeshivot today, the tractates that are studied the most are in Nezikin. Well, again, I mean, there's no particular magic in that. I mean, Moed is certainly as relevant as anything else, but Nashim and Nezikin tend to be the favored tractates in intensive study. Kadshim or sacrifices. Now, Kadshim, for hundreds of years, was largely ignored in the yeshivot. People weren't learning Kadshim. But starting with around the Chafetz Chaim, who was a great man who just died in 1933, he reinstituted the study of Kadshim, because he felt that this would bring the Mashiach faster if we get involved in the details of studying the Korbanot. Now you know that in Yerushalayim here, there are a number of yeshivot that specialize in teaching young priests the details of the temple sacrifice. There is the yeshiva Teretz Kohanim, which means the crown of Kohanim. And I remember there was an article in Time magazine probably 2 years ago. Apparently these people are making models of the things that are going to be used in the Beis HaMikdash, and they're showing them on display and everything else. Well, they're more of an activist bent, and most people would say that we really shouldn't get involved in building the temple till Mashiach comes. That's what the Rambam says. The Rambam says that it's not that we build the temple and then Mashiach comes, rather Mashiach has to come first. Nevertheless, even if we don't go around building the physical Beis HaMikdash, certainly we do help bring the redemption by studying about the Beis HaMikdash. And in fact, the Gemara says that when there was a temple, the sacrifices used to be an atonement for us. And now that there's no Beis HaMikdash, what is our atonement? And we say, one who learns about the Beis HaMikdash and the sacrifices is given the merit as if they brought those korbanot. That's why Kadshim is a fairly important thing to try to learn, even though it's not something that's immediately practical today. And Taharot deals with the laws of purity and impurity, such as the laws regarding a mikveh, a ritual bath, the laws regarding coming in contact with a dead body. All of these laws are in the Seder of Taharot. Now, largely, most of those laws aren't that important today, because number one, all of us are considered to be in a state of tumah. And the reason that's so is the following. If you have ever been in a cemetery in your life, so you are automatically ritually tamei, impure. I'll explain what that is. Until you undergo a purification rite. Now the purification rites require immersion in a mikveh, which we do have today, but also it requires that you be sprinkled with the ashes of the red cow. Have you heard about the mitzvah of the red cow? This is called a chok. A chok is a law for which we don't know any reason. We really don't know the reason for this. Yeah.
What's it with the convert?
Huh? Okay, let me explain this a little bit, because we have a variety of functions. It's a digression a little bit, but just in terms of understanding the idea. We have a word in the Torah called tamei, which means impure, And we have a word in the Torah called tahar, which means pure. Certain things make a person tamei. Certain things, so when a person is not tamei, a person is tahar. Generally speaking, the things that make a person tamei is contact with death. So of course, if I touch a dead body, I am tamei. If I am in the same room as a dead body, I am tamei. If I walk over a dead body, I am tamei. Many, now if I'm tamei for 7 days, if I touch a dead animal, I'm not tamei for 7 days, I'm tamei for 1 day. Okay? A woman who menstruates is tamei. What does menstruation have to do with death? Very obvious. What is menstruation? Menstruation is the shedding of a lining that indicates a pregnancy did not take place that month. That is death. When a man has a seminal emission, he is tamei, because that too is the potential life that is ebbing from the body. If a person is a leper, they are tamei, because leprosy, which is not modern leprosy, but the tzarat in the Torah, is a disintegration of the skin. So the common denominator of tamei is contact with death and decay in many of its forms. It's not a hygienic idea. It's not a question of dirt or filth. It is a spiritual idea of contact with death. Now, what does it mean to be tamei? What can a tamei person not do? It doesn't mean as much. It doesn't mean you're sent into exile, except in the case of a leper. The leper, indeed, is ostracized. But other than that, a person who's tamei goes about his business. You wear tefillin and you daven, you do mitzvot, you live in your community. But the one disability that a tamei has is a tamei may not enter the temple and a tamei may not partake of the special sacrificial foods. In other words, if you're tamei, you have to distance yourself from the holy places. Now, once a person has become tamei, they cannot regain their tahor status unless they have certain rituals. Let's take the person who walked into a cemetery or the person who came in contact with a dead body. There are two things that person has to do. He has to go into, he has to count 7 days, and after, on the seventh day, he goes to a mikvah, which is a ritual bath. But number two, the Torah has a ceremony involving an animal called a red cow. This is very, very unusual. You have to find a red cow, and the red cow has to be totally red. If you have one black hair, it's still acceptable. If you have two black hairs, got to go over it hair by hair, no good. And then you take the red cow, and there's a whole ceremony, and the priests are supposed to burn the red cow into ashes, mix it with water, and sprinkle some of the ashes and water on a tamei person on day three of the impurity. Let's assume that it's on Monday. So Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. So Wednesday is day three, and then Thursday is four, Friday is five, Shabbos is six, Sunday is seven. This is called hazaah, sprinkling. And then if a person was sprinkled twice and went into the mikvah, he is tahar. Now, today, because we don't have the red cow, and some say occasionally you'll see some excitement in Israel, they feel they've discovered the red cow, etc. But generally speaking, something happens. Either it has a black hair or something, it's no good. That's why they're working on genetic engineering now to try to produce one. But until you have that ceremony, you are tamei your whole life. In other words, you cannot get out of the tumah until you have the ceremony. That's why all of us today are technically in a status of tumah. That is why religious people do not cross over the other side of the Western Wall. Because the Western Wall, technically the Western Wall is not the wall of the temple, as you know. It's the wall of the temple mount. Right? This was a mountain. But technically a person that's tamei is not permitted to enter the temple mount. Again, I mean, Israel is not going to stop you if you want to enter. Of course, it might be a little dangerous now with the Arabs. But at least if you're halakhically committed, you will not cross the Temple Mount because you're in a state of tumah. Okay? Now, so that's one thing. So all of those laws, all of those details are in the order of taharot. Now, let me just answer your question. Now, mikveh serves multiple functions. Let me explain how this is. Mikveh is a vehicle of purification for somebody that was tamei, such as contact with the dead, or a woman that's a menstruant. Now there, she doesn't need sprinkling with the paraduma, that's only mikveh. So some of the purification rituals require sprinkling, other things don't. But mikveh is also a medium for conversion. Now, why is mikveh? In fact, we use mikveh for three things, really. We use a mikveh if a person's tamei, a mikveh can make them tahar. We use a mikveh for conversion when a non-Jew converts to Judaism. And there's a third use we have for a mikveh that very few people outside of the Orthodox community know about, and that's...
Tiveling.
Well, tiveling just means immersing, but you mean tiveling...
Kuyus.
Right. There is a concept that inanimate objects are immersed in a mikveh. Specifically, if you buy anything that you will use with food preparation that is made out of glass or metal, so for example, spoons, forks, knives, pots and pans, or glassware. Yeah. Glass or metal. Glass or metal that will be used with food preparation. The law, and it was owned by a non-Jew. It was owned by a non-Jew. Before you're allowed to use it, you have to immerse it in a mikveh. So mikveh kicks in at three points. It is a purification ritual for someone that is tameh, sometimes alone, like in the case of the menstruant, and sometimes in conjunction with the ashes of the parah aduma, the red cow. That's category number one. Category number two is conversion, geirut. Category number three is for metal and glass utensils that are used in food preparation. What is the common denominator between these disparate things? Basically, the notion is that a mikveh, immersion in water, of course, and this is where Christians got baptism. Baptism was an adaptation of the Jewish idea of immersion. Immersion is rebirth and recreation, right? A baby in utero, in the uterus, is essentially in water. When we immerse ourselves totally in water, we are, as it were, we cease to live for that moment. First of all, when you're underwater, you're in an environment, really, that you're dead. You can't live for more than a few seconds. And then you're reborn again and you're recreated. And that's an escape of tumah because you're cutting off that past and you're becoming reborn. That's the idea of conversion. And ironically, even utensils undergo conversion because they're now going to be used for a Jewish table and they have to undergo a geirut just like a person undergoes a conversion. Now, the question about that you asked is the following. Once a non-Jew converts to Judaism by immersion to the mikveh, the non-Jew is a Jew. There is no spiritual impurity based on being a non-Jew. However, the other impurity, namely contact with a dead body, the non-Jew shares in common with Jews because the non-Jew needs the ritual of the sprinkling of the parah aduma, which means conversion does not require the sprinkling of the red heifer, but contact with the dead does, and therefore it's a complicated thing. The mikveh can accomplish the conversion 100%, but it cannot accomplish the purification from contact with the dead except in conjunction with the other ceremony. However, I want to emphasize that being tamei because of a dead body does not create any particular disability other than the ability to go into the temple and participate of sacrifices. And the fact that you and I are tamei has no particular significance for us. Particularly when there's no temple. When there's a temple, obviously it would mean we couldn't do certain things. In fact, if you recall now, this is the story of the Jews that came to Moshe when the Pesach offering was being offered, and they had come in contact with the dead, and they said to Moshe, why should we lose our chance to bring the sacrifice of God? And therefore, what did Moses do? He gave them a second chance by allowing them to bring the Pesach offering 1 month later. And that is what is called Pesach Sheni. We don't observe it as a holiday today, but they had 1 month later for people who couldn't do it. So that's an example of a person who cannot bring a sacrifice because they're tamei. Yes?
What about Kohanim? If they are assumed to be tamei, then why do they bother paying such close attention to not going to...
Yeah, excellent point. And you know, let me just elaborate on that. You know that a Kohen is not allowed to come in contact with the dead, a member of the priestly family. And that's why Kohanim don't go to funerals except of their own immediate relatives. That's why there's even a She'elah, a question of a Kohen being allowed to travel to Israel on an airplane if there is a body in the cargo hold. You know, very often they take dead bodies to Israel for burial. And the answer would be, so the question that was raised is, if all of us are Tamei anyway, so what's a Kohen doing worse by going to a funeral? The answer to that is that this is predicated on the assumption that even if you're Tamei, you're not allowed to make yourself Tamei again.
That's the concept. The concept is that every tumah is adding something, and therefore the kohen is not supposed to keep on doing it.
So the people that are in Chevra Kedisha that do tahara, they're adding.
Yes, they are. They are. But once again, the mitzvah of burying the dead overrides any problem. There's a kohen can't be in a Chevra Kedisha, right. But for Yisrael, there's no prohibition to become tameh. And the mitzvah of working with the dead would make it a mitzvah to do that. But technically, they're becoming more tamei every time. It's kind of a quantitative addition. Now, there is one opinion of the Ravid that says that because all kohanim are tamei, he would permit a kohen to go to a funeral today. And we occasionally use the Ravid in conjunction with a lot of other opinions to come up with a lenient result, but we don't follow the Ravid standing alone. That's a very minority opinion. Okay. So six orders of the Mishnah. Let me just give you a little bit of a breakdown because it's important information to have. Each order of the Mishnah is called a Seder. So we have six Siddarim of the Mishnah. Six orders of the Mishnah. Right? Zeraim, Moed, Nashim, Nizikin, Kodshim, Taharot. The orders in turn are broken down into tractates. Tractate is an English word, or treatises, and the treatises are called masechtot. That's plural, masechtot. Singular is masechta. In English, the spelling would be M-A-S-E-C-H-T-A. And I'll give you an example of some. They're all together 63 tractates. So of the six orders of the Mishnah, you have 63 tractates. Examples would be, In the order of Zeraim, we have tractates such as Brachot, dealing with blessings. We have tractates about Truma, dealing with taking off Truma, etc. Bikurim, which is first fruits. Shviyis, which is Shemitah. Right, that's in the tractates in the order of Zeraim. In tractate of holidays, we have the obvious candidates. You could probably name them, most of them, just by picking the holidays. We have one on Shabbos. We have one on Pesach. We have one on Rosh Hashanah. We have Yom Kippur, which is called Yuma. We have Sukkah. Each holiday has its own tractate, except for the holiday of Shavuos, which doesn't have its own tractate because Shavuos does not have its distinctive mitzvot. There is a tractate called Shavuos, but there it means oaths, and it's not part of the holiday one. It's a totally different thing. Nashim, we have things like Gittin, which is divorce, and we have Kedushin, which is marriage. You know the old joke that people say, in the order of Nashim, the tractate of Gittin, of divorce, is mentioned before the tractate of marriage. It says, first there's Gittin, then there's Kiddushin. Why do you mention divorce before marriage? So the old joke, and no, it's not taken as truth, just a little joke people say, is that it's God's way that God always gives you the medicine before he gives you the sickness. In other words, God prepares the refuah before the makkah, so God gives you the way out before he gives you the way in. But that's not the real reason, as I say, that's just a joke people say. But the point is, we do have these tractates. Mizikin, we have the famous things, Bava Kama, Bava Metzia, Bava Basra. What does that mean? Bava means gates. Bava Kama just means first gates, second gates, third gates. Very undescriptive. But the reason is, each of these tractates has 10 chapters. So originally, it was one big tractate called Mizikin, Laws of Damages. And part one was called Bava Kama. So really, Bava Kama just means part one. Bava Metzia is part two. Bava Basra is part three. But Bava Kama deals primarily with torts. Torts are injuries to person or property. Bava Metzia deals with things like contracts and labor obligations and the like. And Bava Basra deals with sales and inheritance. It's interesting. People don't realize what's in the Talmud. People think, you know, Judaism teaches you how to keep Shabbos and how to keep kosher. But if you want to know how to conduct a business, you go to a lawyer or the like. Well, no. Huge portions of the Talmud are dealing with partnerships and business and contracts and leases and interest and loans. And in fact, there's more of the Talmud that deals with business law than there is regarding the part of the Talmud that deals with ritual law. More of the Talmud deals with business law. And it's a funny thing that a typical yeshiva curriculum may resemble almost a law school curriculum more than a theological seminary curriculum, because you're studying about contracts and torts and partnerships and all that type of thing. Okay. And in Kachim, we have tractates dealing with different types of sacrifices and the like. Okay. So again, we have six Siddarim.
Each Seder is divided into a Maseches, a number of tractates. Each tractate is divided into Prakim, which are chapters. And each chapter is divided into paragraphs, which are called Mishnas, individual Mishnas. Typically, when we give cross-references to Mishnah, we don't have to use the Seder, we just use the tractate, because most people know what order a tractate is in. So for example, if I'm learning the first paragraph of the fifth chapter of Brachot that deals with the laws of prayer, I will simply say Perek Chamishi, fifth chapter, Masechet Brachot, Tractate Brachot, Mishnah Aleph, first Mishnah. Technically, if I wanted to be accurate, I would say Order of Zra'im, Tractate Brachos, chapter 5, Mishnah 1. But very often we leave out the reference to the order because most people know Tractate Brachos is in the order of Zra'im. Okay, this is the Mishnah. Now the Mishnah, again, was written in around the year 130 of the Common Era. If you know your Jewish history, you'll recognize that the temple was destroyed in the year 70 or 68, perhaps, of the Common Era. And therefore, this was written approximately 70 or so years after the destruction of the temple. And it was a time when Roman persecutions were very great. And as I mentioned before, there was a fear that the oral tradition would be lost. Therefore, the Mishnah had to be written down. The Mishnah is not a complete code of law. And why is that so? Because number one, the Mishnah contains many opinions. In the Mishnah, it's not going to say the law is so-and-so. It'll say, Rabbi so-and-so says this, Rabbi so-and-so says this. And it doesn't tell you who to follow. The Mishnah is also incomplete, because the concept was that since the oral law is not supposed to be written down, they only permitted enough of it to be written down to jog somebody's memory. It's like an outline or a note or the like. And therefore, a full understanding of the Mishnah is still dependent on oral elaboration and discussion. And over the next 400 to 500 years, those discussions continued in the great yeshivots, the great academies of Israel, and in Babylonia in particular. And 400 or 500 years later, they resulted in the writing down of the Gemara. Okay, so Mishnah literally means study, and Gemara also means learning or studying. And what the Gemara is this. The Gemara is a commentary and an elaboration of the Mishnah. Together, Mishnah plus Gemara equals the work that we call Talmud. So Talmud is technically two books in one. It is Mishnah and Gemara. You can look at the Mishnah separately. The Mishnah has been reprinted separately, and we learn it separately. But Mishnah and Gemara comprise Talmud. Now, because the Gemara is an elaboration on the Mishnah, you can have, for every line of Mishnah, you might have 10 pages of Talmud. So, just pass me the Gemara over there. See, this says here, Talmud Bavli, the Babylonian Talmud. We open up to the first page, which, by the way, traditionally, all pages of Gemara begin from page 2. The first daf, the first page in a Gemara, is never daf aleph. It is never page 1. It is always page 2. Why is that? Probably was just a printing convention, but the reason that we like to give is that a person should feel they've never even begun. They've never even hit aleph yet. No matter how much you learn, you've never really begun. You're in the middle somewhere, but you've never really started. Anyway, these three lines are the Mishnah. Arei Mishnah. This is Mishnah 1 of chapter 1 of Tractate Sukkah. Tractate Sukkah, as you would expect, deals with the laws.
10 double-sided pages of Gemara, and that takes us until Mishnah 2, which is on page 10, which is really page 20, towards the bottom of the page. And there's always a big black letter, Matznisan, which means Mishnah. It tells you when the new Mishnah starts. I'm not talking about the stuff on the side yet. I'm just talking about the middle column. Okay, this is called Talmud. Now, the Talmud does a lot of things. The Talmud, number one, explains the Mishnah, because sometimes Mishnahs are ambiguous and contradictory. It resolves contradictions, because a Mishnah here will say one thing and a Mishnah there will say something else. You've got to kind of reconcile them. In addition, it will give derivations for laws, because sometimes the Mishnah will say a law and won't give you a reason or won't give you a source in the written Torah for a law. And the Gemara will flesh that out. And the Gemara also contains new material. Sometimes the rabbis of the Gemara will just discuss a new issue that was not mentioned in the Mishnah. So in other words, it both explains the Mishnah and it supplements the Mishnah with new material. Okay? Once again, however, the Gemara is not a law book. What the Gemara is essentially, the closest parallel we could do is, if you take the transcripts of the Congressional Record. Congressional Record is a transcript of the debates that go on in Congress every day. They're not the laws, they are the discussions of the laws. The Talmud is not concerned with giving you final law. It does not give you final law. The Talmud is in the form of a debate, but it's a debate that spans 500 years. So it'll start off by saying, Rabbi so-and-so raised the question, and Rabbi so-and-so gave an answer. And then somebody else said, well, that answer is no good because that contradicts something else. And someone else will say, well, that's not a question because I can answer that one with somewhere else. And the debate goes on and on. And sometimes the people who are talking are hundreds of years apart, but they were edited as if they're talking to each other. So what you're doing when you're doing Talmud is you're not learning law. You're learning process. You're learning how to think about Jewish law, how to analyze, how to reconcile contradictions. And that's why sometimes it might be frustrating for people, because you're learning, first of all, the language itself is difficult, but you know, sometimes people think, if only I knew Aramaic, because Talmud is not actually Hebrew. Mishnah is Hebrew. The Gemara, which is the second part of the Talmud, is a combination of Hebrew and Aramaic, which is a Hebrew dialect. Aramaic is somewhat, it's not Arabic, Aramaic is somewhat similar to Hebrew. To give you an example, shalom in Hebrew would be shalama in Aramaic, peace. Zahav in Hebrew would be dahava, dahava in Aramaic. You can see the resemblance. Yeshiva in Hebrew would be misivta in Aramaic. So there are similarities, kind of, but you know, you wouldn't guess them unless you had some familiarity with the language. But people often think, gee, if I only knew Aramaic, Gemara would be so easy for me. Well, unfortunately, it's not easy for anybody. And that is, language is only a small part of the complexity of Gemara. We have translations, and if you look at the translation, you'll see that it doesn't fully resolve the issue. What you're really dealing with is tight, intensive, logical structures that sometimes get your head spinning. Contradictions are raised and they have to be answered, and when you start off at point one, you may wind up at point 99, but then you have to remember what point one was and connect all of those points together. And it's very helpful if you are going to be learning Gemara to always make outlines of your discussion. Like we have question, answer, refutation, refutation to the refutation, which of course reinstates the answer to the question, right? In other words, you have to keep that type of step-by-step analysis. That if you ask a question, I give an answer, and somebody refutes my answer, but then somebody refutes the refutation, that in effect reinstates the answer. So you kind of have to always keep that sequence in your mind. So the Gemara is not interested in clarifying final halacha, but it is interested in clarifying all of the opinions in the Mishnah, reconciling contradiction, talking about new material. And the truth of the matter is, it's designed to help us understand how we get the final decision. But it does not always give you the final decision. There are two Gemaras. There is the Babylonian
Talmud. Now the Mishnah is the same in both. The Mishnah is the Mishnah. There's only one Mishnah. But we have the Babylonian Talmud, which is what we normally learn in the yeshivas. But there's also a much smaller Jerusalem Talmud. Now this is called Talmud Yerushalmi. The same Mishnah, but different Gemara. The Talmud Yerushalmi is not studied as often, and as a source of halacha, as a source of Jewish law, it's considered to be less definitive. And it's much smaller and it's much more difficult. Interestingly enough, if you take the order Zeraim, which I mentioned, there is no Babylonian Talmud on it. There is a Jerusalem Talmud on it, for, I guess, the obvious reason that since the Jerusalem Talmud was written in the land of Israel, the laws of Zeraim were much more relevant. Keep in mind, however, that in a piece of Gemara, there tends to be a lot of free association, which means the Gemara might be a Mishnah might talk about Sukkah. But the Gemara, in the course of analyzing the law of Sukkah, will bring in things about Shabbos and Kashrus and contract law and Shemitah and many other things because they all have a bearing analytically on it. So the truth of the matter is, even if there's no Gemara directly on the order of Zeraim, there are many, many passages in the Babylonian Talmud that deal with these laws. In other words, that's why the truth of the matter is, in order to be an expert in any area of Jewish law, you have to know the whole Talmud. Because let's assume I know tractate Shabbos, Masechet Shabbos, very well, which is 24 chapters, all the laws of Shabbos. But I could still be ignorant of a lot of stuff about Shabbos that is in 20 other tractates. So until I've checked, now with computers perhaps you can make it a little easier with checks and the like, but until I know all of those references, I don't know the law. And moreover, because of the conceptual unity of Torah, even if you know everything in the Talmud about Shabbos, you don't really know unless you can relate to partnership and other things, because everything can have a connection. Right? The brilliant halakhic deciders are able to show the connections between every single part of Torah, this total. When I say Torah, I don't mean the Chumash, I mean Torah meaning the Talmud and everything else. Okay? So this is the Talmud. The Talmud, again, is the analogy that is used is the Talmud, the Gemara. Okay, Gemara technically is the second work, but we use Talmud for Mishnah and Gemara, we call it Gemara. The Gemara is normally described as the ocean of the Talmud, the Yam HaTalmud. You see why? Because it is a sea. It's an inexhaustible sea that you can keep on swimming in and swimming in and never get, never really fully exhaust. And that is why the greatest minds can study this over and over and over again. You know, the Talmud itself consists of how many pages? Let's see. By a page, I mean two sides of a page. Just a little piece of vocabulary. The word daf, which means page, refers to a double page. And the first side, each side of the page is called amud, column. So if I want to refer to a Gemara on daf chaf of Sukkah, page 20 of Sukkah, I would say daf chaf, page 20, amud aleph, first side. Or daf chaf, page 20, amud beis, second side. And very often in Hebrew, the way they show amud, the way they show columns, is by one dot or two dots. So I would write sukkah, daf, I would make a chaf, and I would put one period after it if I meant first side of the page, and I would put two periods after it if I meant second side of the page. Okay. All right. Now the issue is this. In the post-Talmudic era, we have three types of literature which is used in halakhic decision making. First and foremost, we have commentaries on the Talmud. The Talmud itself is not easy to understand unless you have commentaries that explain what the Talmud means. The greatest of the commentaries on the Talmud is by the same person who wrote the greatest of the commentaries on the Torah, on the five books of Moses, and that is none other than the great Rashi. Rashi is an abbreviation for Rav Shlomo, right? Rashi, Rav Shlomo ben Yitzchak. He lived in France in the 11th century, and he wrote commentaries on the entire Talmud. Rashi, by convention, is always printed on the inner margin of a Talmud page, because that's the primary source. And it's been well said that without Rashi's commentary, the Talmud would have been lost from the Jewish people, in a literal sense. We just would not have known what is going on at all. And if you ever if you ever want to test the truth of that assertion, try learning a page of Talmud without looking at Rashi, and see where that gets you, and then look at Rashi and it makes the difference. On the outer side of the Talmud page, we have commentaries that are called Tosfos. Tosfos literally means additions. They are additions to Rashi's commentaries, and they are primarily by Rashi's own grandchildren. Rabbeinu Tam, Rashi had no sons. Rashi had five very distinguished daughters. According to tradition, Rashi's daughters even wore tefillin, which women normally don't do because they were so great in their own right. And according to some traditions, one of the commentaries on the Talmud, one of the tractates, was not authored by Rashi, but in fact was authored by Rashi's daughter. This hasn't been totally verified, but many people have said that. Now Rashi, as it were, does not get involved directly in kind of raising, sometimes there are contradictions in the Gemara. A Gemara in Shabbos may say one thing, and a Gemara somewhere else may say something else. Rashi does not directly involve himself in reconciling those contradictions, but that is something that Tosfos does a lot. So Tosfos will very often bring in, well, how could the Gemara here say this? Doesn't it contradict that? And he will come up with a new explanation. Sometimes, this is Rashi's greatness, sometimes the way Rashi explains the Gemara, he answers the question without having to ask it. In other words, it's as if Rashi was aware of all of these difficulties, and sometimes he says, well, instead of confusing you by raising you a lot of questions, I'll just explain it in a way that all difficulties disappear. You see, so that's an extreme talent. Tosfos, on the other hand, elaborates and raises these questions. That's why when you're learning Tosfos already, you really have to have a whole set of Talmud next to you, because Tosfos is constantly cross-referencing other discussions. And you're going to have to check those other discussions, because it's very hard to take a line of Talmud out of context and know what it's talking about. See? That's the Tosfos. Yeah?
How many books are there?
Oh, how many books are there? Well, the Talmud itself, as I say, contains 63 tractates. They are normally printed in 20 volumes. But again, they can be printed in different sets. I've seen a Talmud printed in one fat volume, you know, huge thing. But the standard printing is 20 volumes, 63 tractates. Rashi and Tosfos are not printed as separate books. Rashi and Tosfos, can you pass me the Gemara? I just want to show people. Rashi and Tosfos are printed together with the Talmud itself. So if I open up any page of Talmud, this is Talmud, either Mishnah or Gemara. The inner column is always going to be Rashi, and you follow Rashi to get a sense of the line-by-line discussion. And then when you're more advanced, you look at the Tosfos in the outer margin, which will raise all sorts of questions from other tractates and try to reconcile them. Okay, so Rashi in the inner corner, Tosfos in the outer corner. In addition, we do have hundreds and hundreds of other commentaries that are printed in separate books. If you were to ask me how many books there are altogether, it could be 500,000. Now, not all books are the same. Just like Lamashal in a court system. You know, the United States Supreme Court is a court, and the small claims court, Judge Wapner, People's Court, is a court, right? The court says, Judge Wapner says, and the Supreme Court says, you know, they're not the same. Well, the truth of the matter is, people write for him every day. I mean, even today, people are writing commentaries on the Talmud, some of which are quite good. But there is a hierarchy. You know, you can't like blindly say, well, this book says this, and this book says this, so we have two opinions. I mean, you know, the Rambam says something is not the same as my writing something in a letter. So there is definitely a hierarchy, but in terms of Svarim, there must be 500,000 books. We have a tremendous, tremendous amount of literature. Now, these are commentaries. Now, I want to emphasize, a commentary still does not tell you the halacha. The commentary explains all the different views in the Talmud, but it still doesn't tell you who you're supposed to follow. So a second group of literature that we have are not the commentary literature, but it's what is called the psak literature. Psak halacha means deciser literature, literature that tells you halacha. Who do you follow when you have many opinions? And keep in mind that the Talmud does not clearly tell you what the halakha is for a variety of reasons. Number one, what the Talmud means. There are arguments among commentators what the Talmud means. So obviously if you have arguments what the Talmud means, you have to know what to follow. Number two, the Talmud itself records many opinions. Okay? So because of this, the Talmud does not tell you what halacha is, but we have Sifrei Psak, Psak Halacha, which tells you. And again, the main ones are the Rambam, Rav Moshe ben Maimon, who lived in Spain in the 1100s. He wrote a book called the Mishneh Torah, which is called the Repetition of the Torah. And his theory was, all you need is to learn Chumash, learn the written law, and learn my book, which extracts everything from the Talmud and everything else and all the rabbinic decrees, without giving you the whole elaborate discussion, and you will know Jewish law. Now the Rambam was very criticized in his time, because the Rambam essentially said, he didn't give sources for his views. He didn't say, this law is based on tractate Shabbat. So all the commentators after the Rambam, see, this is kind of a vicious circle that's at work here. The literature of Psak Halacha was designed to simplify halachic decision making. Because to wade through the Talmud, we have to learn hundreds and hundreds of pages with commentaries and complications, and then you still don't know a final answer. And as generations were getting weaker and weaker intellectually, it was felt they need a black letter, they need a guide, they need definite instruction. So we have attempts by the Rambam to simplify Jewish law by giving you the answer. And the Rambam says, I'm not going to tell you where to look, because if I tell you where to look, you're going to get involved in that whole process again, you're going to get lost in the ocean of the Talmud. So the Rambam instead said, I'm not going to tell you where I got this from. This is the answer, trust me. The Rambam, of course, was great enough to make that assertion, but some of the Rambam's contemporaries said, well, why should I trust you? You tell me where you got it from. And in either event, what we have is that simplicity always backfires. Because after the Rambam tried to make things simple, the commentaries written on the Rambam saying, well, the Rambam must have gotten it from this Gemara. But doesn't this Gemara contradict that Gemara? And how do we reconcile it? And we have a huge commentary literature on the Rambam, which is primarily concerned with elucidating the Rambam sources and reconciling the Rambam with other passages in the Talmud. And what's interesting is that the Rambam did not write a commentary on the Gemara. But we work backwards. From the Rambam's halacha, we can infer how he must have understood the Gemara. And ironically, it's very often not the same as Rashi's understanding. So one of the high academic pursuits in the yeshiva world is to try to reconstruct backwards how Maimonides understood the Talmudic text. You see the process? Because the process is, Maimonides kind of gives you a result, but he doesn't take you through his thinking process. So we have our Talmud, which is the raw material out of which halacha is derived, and we have his result, and we have to figure out, well, gee, how do you get from A, we have the A and we have the Z, how does he get from A to Z? And that could be very, very complicated, because very often, if we look at Rashi's explanation as the A, that's not going to come out with Z, that's going to come out with Z prime. So we have to work backwards, and it takes a lot of ingenuity and creativity to try to figure out how the Rambam understood. But now what's interesting is, though, that to some extent, this academic enterprise defeats the Rambam's very purpose. The Rambam tried to simplify and unify. Instead, it spawned this tremendous complexity. What happened then was, the Shulchan Aruch was written, other codes, and every few hundreds of years, we try to get a code that is a definitive code that will give you the solid answer. And that in turn spawns commentaries on the codes which create this complexity. So the truth of the matter is that what the lesson of this is, that Torah is, and by Torah I mean the whole complex of Jewish law, is infinitely complex, and any attempts to truly simplify it are doomed to failure in the ultimate sense, that you try to put it in a box and eventually the box is going to explode and it's going to come out again. But once again, we do have hierarchies, we do have, you know, sources where we look at. Again, as commentators, Rashi and Tosfos are the main commentators. As codes, we have Maimonides and the Shulchan Aruch. And then we have, what time is it now? Okay, this can be another few minutes, then we'll go from Mincha. And then there's a third strand that we have, and that is responsa literature. These are called she'elot uteshuvot, or she'elos uteshuvos. I don't know if you use Ashkenaz or Sephardi here. Okay, she'elos uteshuvos, and literally this means questions and answers. Let me explain how this comes up. in the course of the Jewish people living in many, many places for hundreds and hundreds of years, questions would always come up, new situations. What do I do? How do I kosher my microwave oven for Pesach? Right? Am I allowed to buy gum that's not certified as kosher? These are questions that would be addressed to rabbis. And in the course of the year, certain rabbis became leaders in responding to these questions. And they would write written replies to communities. Right? Remember, most of this occurred before the telephone, before the fax machine. So the way you'd answer a question would be to write. But you didn't just say a yes or a no. A rabbi wouldn't just say yes, no. A rabbi would always try to explain. In other words, if it was a difficult question, the rabbi would try to explain the reasoning of the decision to give people guidance. So a she'elah just means a question that was forwarded to a rabbi for a response. A teshuvah is an answer to that question, typically citing sources, and those sources would usually be in the Talmud or in the posek literature, such as citations to Rambam, Shulchan Aruch, and commentaries. And eventually, if the rabbi had enough people asking him questions and it was considered to be authoritative enough, these would often be published in books, which are called She'elot U'Teshuvot. Now, how many of those we have? We must have, again, a few thousand of them, of widely differing authority. You have people who are considered to be the most greatest authorities in halacha, and then you have average Joes who wanted to publish a book. Again, you have to be, you have to know what is authoritative. But these are Sheilas U'Teshuvot, and they span a tremendous geographical diversity. We have Sheilas U'Teshuvot from every single country the Jews lived in. We're talking about Spain and Portugal and Bulgaria and Romania and Russia and Poland and South Africa and Australia. And one of the side benefits is that not only are these repositories of halakhic concepts, but these are very valuable repositories of historical knowledge. I mean, if you're an academic and you want to know, gee, what type of economic conditions were the Jews living in Austria in the 1500s? What's the best way of checking that? Look at the questions that were asked in the She'elot U'Teshuvot of the 1500s, you see? If people are asking about tenant farming and sharecropping and shipping, then that is indicative of what they were doing. So the She'elot U'Teshuvot are always a pulse on what a community is looking at. Today, for example, Rav Moshe Feinstein, who was considered to be the greatest posek in the United States, or in the world perhaps, died in 1985. He has 7 volumes of responsa. So if you look, you'll see things, of course, I don't think there's anything about AIDS because he kind of predated the AIDS epidemic, but you'll see stuff about artificial insemination and surrogate motherhood, genetic engineering, smoking, are Jews allowed to smoke, right? He'll discuss that. So even people who aren't religious, historians, for example, delve into the She'elot U'Teshuvot to reconstruct history. Now, of course, that's not their main purpose for us. Their main purpose is they are a source of Jewish law. But they also have a lot of tremendous amount of history. The problem with She'elot U'Teshuvot for many years was there were no indexes. So how do I know if a given topic is discussed in a responsa literature? See, the Shulchan Aruch I could check, because Shulchan Aruch is organized, laws of prayer, laws of Shema. But if I have 1,000 responsa books, how am I supposed to know what they cover? The Bar Ilan University now is involved in a long-term project to computerize all the responsa literature. So, for example, if I want to know, have the responsa talked about insurance, I can submit a search request to Bar Ilan, and they will give me references, at least, not full text necessarily, but they will give me references that in the following 30 books, insurance is discussed. Okay, so you can do a whole thing. What's interesting is, just tells you, some of our great gedolim literally are computers. Rav Avadya Yosef, who was the former Sephardic chief rabbi, it's funny, and he has an encyclopedic memory for like thousands and thousands of these books. And it's funny, when they wanted to test the Bar Ilan system, the way they tested it was, they submitted a search to Rav Avadya Yosef, they said, write down the references on insurance, and then they did it through the computer. And what they did was, see, our computer really works because we came up with the same source as he did. So, you know, he did it without the computer. That's how you test the computer, is using him as your base. So, now, on the other hand, let me say too, on the other hand, there are great rabbis who don't look at the responsa literature. They basically say, I'll go through the Talmud myself and come up to my own conclusion. So in deciding a halacha, you'll find two different styles. Some are very preoccupied to examine what every other rabbi has ever written. And others say, I will go to the primary sources, which is the Talmud and Maimonides and the Shulchan Aruch, and I will reconstruct my view. And if some other rabbi said differently, that's something else. But see, the Talmud and the Maimonides and the Shulchan Aruch are definitive sources. The Shailos and Tshuvos are kind of a less definitive source. Let me just end with this point, and that is, there's a symbiotic relationship between commentary, code, and responsa. Let me explain how that's so. The responsa are usually the first line that deals with new issues. In other words, you're not going to look up in the Shulchan Aruch and see microwaves and genetic engineering and the like. That'll be in responsa literature. But after you have hundreds of years of responsa literature, so consensuses eventually emerge, then when a new code is written, and there are codes written occasionally, the responsa will be incorporated in the code. In other words, the code is a repository for settled wisdom. The responsa is kind of the ongoing live process. Okay, so responsas are the raw material out of which codes are fashioned. The responsa in turn use the codes as the basis for answering new questions. And all of this goes back to the Talmud and the commentaries on the Talmud. Okay, so the foundation of the whole edifice is the Talmud, commentaries of the Talmud, which then result in codes. New questions present themselves that generate responsa. When you have enough responsa on a given subject, there may be a codification in a code, and then new responsa, new questions come up, but all of it is based on this bedrock foundation. And again, one of the hard things that I really don't have time to do in full is to give you a sense of relative hierarchy, because this is a big problem, because at a time when everybody can get a book printed, so you kind of think, well, this rabbi says this, it really isn't that way. Sometimes it's that way, but there is a hierarchy. Rabbi A is not the same as Rabbi B, and you have to get a sense of who is who in this particular area. Okay, well, see you tomorrow. Take care.